listening to me? Can I talk to you for a second?
Oh my God, I was dying.
You totally have to hear this. Do you have a minute right now?
It's
really
important.
Right
important. Okay.
I just
keep it on the dime. Keep it on the dime.
Hi, welcome to the Overshare Show. I'm Tony, and today we're going to be talking to Sherry Turkle. Sherry is a professor at MIT and also an author of many books, including Alone Together, which is basically about our relationship to technology, specifically our phones. And I think all of us feel a sort of complex dynamic when it comes to how we relate to our phones. On the one hand, yeah, you are more connected. You have access to limitless information and content at the tip of your fingers all the time, and that makes you feel connected to the world in many aspects. But at the same time, we're also more alone because we're looking at our dumb phones all the time. And I think this complexity is something that a lot of us feel, like how we relate to our screens has impacted not only our psychology, but the way that we interact in the world, the way we relate to each other, our relationships to our spouses, our friends, and even our children. As a parent myself, I have had a lot of kind of conflicting opinions about how I use my phone because on the one hand, it helps me and it's been advantageous, especially when she was young and I could listen to podcasts and, you know, search online while she was boring and a baby. But as your child gets older, it's definitely something that separates you if you're spending time with your kid and half the time you're looking at email or searching through Facebook. And I think that most of us are trying to figure out how to navigate a healthy relationship with our phone where we use it for our advantage, but it's not using us. And it's not like I'm saying that we're in some sort of transhumanist nightmare where our phone has a consciousness that's using us for its own advantage, but we are in many ways becoming slaves to the technology and we're tethered to it in a really specific way. If you don't answer your text messages after 6 hours, chances are you're going to get a pretty angry text from the other side being like, hello, where are you? Why aren't you answering me? So, I mean, there is this specific way we have no freedom anymore. You can't just kind of climb a mountain and sit and be and stay with your own consciousness. I mean, you're always kind of like, oh, should I check my phone? Should I see what's going on? And I also think it's worth noting that beforehand in life, pre-cell phones, you really had to live in your own mind a lot more. You had to deal with your own boredom. If you were in line for the bank, it was boring and you had to kind of entertain yourself with your imagination. Or if you were on the train or if you were doing anything where you weren't specifically being stimulated, you had to stimulate your own mind. And now every time you're somewhat bored or somewhat uncomfortable by being alone, you can immediately turn on your phone for instant entertainment and content. And I think there's definitely a danger to that because we're not allowing our minds to wander and just exist in the recesses of our own imaginations. We're constantly interrupting our train of thought by checking our phone. And I do think that is going to have a major psychological impact on not only adults, but children who grow up with phones, which I did not. So I do think Sherry has some fascinating ideas and thoughts about how we can use technology and also looking at this from a pretty philosophical and honest way of being like, hey, everybody, even though we're all connected, we really are still alone. So I hope you guys enjoy this interview. Sherry's incredibly brilliant and you should read all her books. Thank you so much. So I wanted to say one thing, is that when we were meeting you today, I had this idea that we would just both be on our phones and like, hold on a second, we just need a minute.
Right.
So I'm really personally super excited to have this conversation because I do have an addictive relationship with my phone and I'm hyper conscious with it. And you in your book, you talk a lot about the human connection to the phone and what that means to us on both a psychic level, a spiritual level, and a meta level.
Yeah.
So one thing, and this is a quote from you that I would like to start off with, is the idea that technology is seductive
when what it offers meets our human vulnerabilities.
Yes.
So can you go into a little bit about what you meant by that?
Yeah, I say what I mean is that technology has affordances. That means that technology offers us certain things. And what's the catch, the real seductiveness, is when those affordances meet our human vulnerabilities. So, for example, the phones and social media offer us three gifts, or sometimes I think of them as three promises from a benevolent genie. The first is you'll never have to be alone. You can always be heard. And you can go wherever you want to go, say whatever you want to say. Now, that's amazing. It's kind of sort of historically unprecedented.
Right.
So if you're at dinner with boring auntie, you know, there's a Facebook commercial where everybody's at dinner and all of a sudden boring auntie starts to talk about buying a chicken. The teenage girl at the dinner party takes out her phone and all of a sudden she's in all of the exciting places she wants to be. You know, that's unprecedented. You could daydream, but you literally couldn't kind of hang out with your friends. I mean, so I guess what I'm saying is that what's special about these new technologies, and I really disagree with the people who say, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. This is the same thing. It's just more of the same. It's not more of the same. There really is a unique new set of affordances that this technology offers that psychically hooks into us, which is that you never have to be alone. You can always be heard, and you can go wherever you want to go and actually be whoever you want to be once you get there. But that's kind of a different story. The first three are quite enough.
Right. I mean, you bring up the topic of boredom.
Yeah.
And this is something I think a lot about in my own life. So let's say I'm in line at the bank.
Right.
I used to just have to be at line in the bank. And now I can be there and just be scrolling through Facebook.
Right.
So the idea that I'm never really alone with my own boredom anymore, and how
right.
that impacts both my creativity and, like you were saying, my ability to imagine or my mind to wander.
Right.
So, I mean, what have you been in your research looking at when people are having this consequence?
I actually have been looking a lot at boredom, because I think that boredom is kind of a negative way of saying solitude, quiet, daydreaming, mind-wandering moments of creativity. And all of the research shows that mind-wandering, daydreaming, these were really important moments for us. And that we just kind of lump them all into boredom now. Let's go online. Let's do social media at every possible one of those moments. First of all, you know, it takes us away from those moments of solitude where you think about yourself, you think about your friends, you think about your family, you think about people you love or don't love or why you love and don't love them. You think about what your day, you think about gratitude, you put yourself together as a person.
It seems like that's sort of where development happens, in those moments of quiet. That's where growth happens.
Yes.
When you're able to reflect.
Absolutely.
So
and now I talk to people who say the minute that hits, they're out of there and they're on their phone. And I don't think this is a positive outcome. Over and over, I hear people saying to me, phones solve the problem of loneliness. Well, loneliness is the sort of the sad side of solitude. Solitude is not a bad thing. And we don't even want to use the word solitude anymore. We want to immediately say loneliness, because I think we're out of the habit of experiencing solitude. So we immediately go to loneliness because we don't even sort of remember that solitude was a positive thing. I have a house, I'm so privileged. I have a house on Cape Cod right on the beach, and I see people walking on the dunes that Thoreau walked, and everyone has a phone.
Right.
I mean, look up at the sand or the sky or the sea. You know, these are things to look up at. And the people are looking down at their phone. So I'm worried when people say to me, let's solve the problem of loneliness, because I think that they're not pausing to think that maybe they're tagging solitude as loneliness, because the minute they see a teenager alone for a moment, they feel they need to put a phone in their hand.
I mean, I think you have a really interesting quote when you say, people are lonely, the network is seductive, but if we are always on, we may deny ourselves of the rewards of solitude.
Yes.
So I think, you know, what you're touching on is something that I now have to force myself to do.
Yes.
So there are moments where, you know, I live in nature right now. I live in New Hampshire. I used to live in New York City. Now I live in a place where I used to crave that kind of natural solitude. I would come there for that exact experience. And now that I'm surrounded by it, it's almost like I'm craving the exact opposite.
Well, so, it's a balance.
Right.
I mean, I'm not a kind of, listen, I live in a big city. I love to go to New York City. I love the theater. I love the opera. I mean, I'm not the sort of person who, you know, I don't even necessarily feel you need nature to find a moment of solitude. You find a moment of solitude by going within yourself and finding a moment of solitude. So I'm not even saying that this is about, that I'm not preaching a particularly a back to nature moment. I'm preaching a moment when you sort of disconnect from the pressures that other people are putting on you to respond to them and reconnect with what your inner life is telling you you need to find for yourself. Seems connecting that, to yourself.
Right. It seems we're such consumers. It's like, and now this is just part of that. Like our, you know, our economy and everything is based on consumerism. And so this is just more to consume. So we feel like more is more.
It's not only, it's not just more and more. It's what more, what's concerned me sort of in terms of the business world and productivity and the creative mind is the reactivity of how you become when you go online. So, you know, when you leave, when this interview is over, I face hundreds of emails and I feel responsibility to respond to these emails. And I'm being reactive, and some of them are quite interesting, and I'll do some of the things that people ask me to do. But if you're in a position where you can react, particularly in business, and most creative people in business don't even read their emails or, you know, read them very rarely, you know, really get a grip and go to them much less frequently than you'd think, because they need to preserve their creativity and their inward direction. So constantly going to your mail, constantly going to your social network can be a way, not always, but it can be a way of keeping you from your most creative self.
It seems like it's not necessarily originate in like an avoidance, it's like a curiosity, and then it becomes a habit that fuels itself.
That's so very well put.
It's really just the nature of an addiction. It takes on its own life. So it's that Pavlov's dog response.
Yeah. I mean, when I ask people like why, and particularly in my class, it's very touching because I'm a pretty good teacher and people want to pay attention. And every once in a while, somebody will come to me and say, you know, in class, I see they kind of look down at their phone, or sometimes we put the phones in one place and, you know, so they don't, or we have a lot of discussion about this because people get antsy. People get antsy. They want to know, and they say, I just want to know who's reaching out to me. They have no illusions that it's, you know, what it is. They just want to know who's reaching out to me. It's such a poignant comment. So it's just a kind of wanting to know who is reaching out. And that's, I think, the buzz. It's wanting to know who's reaching out, yeah. Wanting to know who wants you.
It just scratches that particular itch.
Yeah.
And it is, it's, you know, we're talking about the things that it solves is being unprecedented. And it does feel like this Prometheus moment, but it's serving this, you know, very basic need. So like we have this incredible ability and these gifts, and I feel like, you know, if Prometheus used, you know, fire to just light cigarettes, you know, that's what it feels like.
That's wonderful, you know, right?
We're just not using it to its best purpose.
Well, I'm optimistic that you know, it's very early days, and it's not necessarily that the first generation who had this technology is going to find the best uses for it, but I think that right now we're distracting ourselves as much as we are finding intentional purpose for it.
I think this idea of distraction, and you also talk about this in your book, is multitasking and paying less attention to each other. And you kind of had this personal story about a girl who would contact her grandmother more, right, but then she was always doing her email.
Right.
And so, you know, I notice in my own life sometimes, if I'm on the phone with someone, that's almost not enough stimulus.
Right.
So I'll often be looking through my Facebook while I'm on the phone, which makes me feel uncomfortable being on the phone because I almost want to get off the phone, but I'm also talking to someone. And so I'm just wondering, this idea of mental stimulus, and if we're just creating a very, very distracted mind.
We are.
It's harder to focus and it's harder to just zone in. I mean, one-on-one, it's easier for me, but definitely on the phone, I find myself more disengaged because I'm antsy.
Yes. I mean, the answer to your question is yes, 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 and yes. And then there's a price to pay. I mean, you can tell when somebody's doing their email when they're talking to you.
Oh, yeah.
And it doesn't inspire what concerns me. I'm studying conversation now. What it concerns me is it doesn't inspire conversations of discovery. Often both people are on their email.
Right, which is so ironic because in order to have a fulfilling conversation, you have to be giving energy to that other person.
Right.
Even if it's on like a quantum or metaphysical level, you're feeding them with your attention and
right,
you're wanting to know what they're going to say.
Right.
So you take that away when you're
right,
multitasking.
So both people are on their emails. I mean, I've interviewed people where, you know, they say, I'm on my email when I do my phone because it's not enough stimulation. The other person's on their email when they do their phone. I can tell. So this conversation is like so boring.
This sucks.
Well, so then they don't like conversation.
Right. It's just stunted and stilted. You know, what were we talking about?
Yeah.
So
then they say, well, I don't like conversation. That's where they go with this. Let's not have conversations. Let's just send emails. Well, that's not necessarily the only conclusion, but that is the conclusion people reach. And that's a shame because conversation, of course, can be very enlivening and very enriching and very exciting. And it's kind of sad that that's where people end up when both people choose to be on email while they talk to each other.
Everything is abbreviated.
Yeah.
You know, especially when you go to communicating through text.
Right.
So one thing that I was also interested in is this idea of identity.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have a phenomenon of, you've heard of the term catfishing.
Yes.
So people creating an identity for themselves that they, you know, is entirely false, mm-hmm, but then they have intimate relationships with people based on a fake identity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so what do you think that that's about? Like, why are people so, What are they finding when they're creating a false identity and having an intimate relationship with somebody online?
Oh, I've been studying this now for 20 years. I studied this in Life on the Screen when people did it on these things called multi-user domains. And people really are trying to express an aspect of themselves that they don't feel is adequately expressed in their real life, in their physically real life. So one of my favorite cases is a man who, as a man, didn't feel permission to be as aggressive as he wanted to be. He saw it as bullying if a man was aggressive. Whereas if a woman was aggressive, he saw it as kind of sexy, a Katharine Hepburn type. He felt permission to be aggressive. And so he went online as a Katharine Hepburn type, as a woman. And he experienced being aggressive, not aggressive, assertive, as a woman. And it was actually a very positive experience. So to me, that's the, you know, the kind of best example of what somebody can positively get out of going online with a gender switch. But many people, you know, they just want to experience being another gender. They want to experience being taller. They want to experience being thinner. You know, there's a desire to be accepted, people say, for my real self, but what my real self usually means is for my insides without letting my outsides get in the way.
But then, I mean, we're talking about avatars where everybody knows that the other person is fake or is creating an ideal version of themselves.
Yes.
But there are people that create an ideal version of themselves and then woo others into relationships and fall in love and have a connection online specifically just based on what someone else looks like, but with their quote unquote insides. So, I mean, what do you think the consequences of that being so
easy? Well, I follow these out to many, in many cases. I mean, the results are mixed.
Right.
Some people really want to keep it online and have the experience of having a romance where really it's their inner self that gets loved and want to keep it online because they just don't want to mess with the other person finding out that they are not attractive, that they're really disabled in some way, that they're much older, that they're much younger. They just feel that there's something within themselves that's worthy of love. And I don't want to glamorize this too much because I'm making this sound like, you know, very often it's children or much older. I mean, I don't want to have much older men. Right. I mean, I don't want to get too misty here, but I mean, it's often people who, for whatever reason, want to have their inner life loved. And I would say that's the best possible spin to put on it. Some people really feel they've found their soulmate online and want to bring it offline. And, you know, there's a period of, I don't know how to put it, let me try to put it correctly, debriefing of the other party in which they say, hey, a couple of things you should know. I'm not Angelina Jolie, but you know, let me count the ways in which I'm not Angelina Jolie. You know, I mean, beginning with that I'm not 5'10", you know, and you know, maybe more, you know, 4'9", and you know, I'm not, I mean,
it does sort of bring up sort of what are our responsibilities to other people in telling the truth. And and this idea that we can express ourselves and be whoever we want to be, does it become sort of deceitful or aggressive, or, you know, when you take away all of the boundaries?
I think it depends what sites you're on. I think if you're on a site that's a dating site and you're with the idea that you're going to be meeting the person, you're just being silly if you know, you can shave off 3 pounds, but you know, by the time you meet the person for drinks, you know, they're either going to notice the 3 pounds. I mean, you can't digress by too much, or you won't match you're not going to match up to the image, and
right.
In nobody's interest. I think on other kinds of sites, you know, it's a little bit user beware because the implied promise is much less clear. It's truly much less clear.
So, and then there's also the idea of cyberbullying and the identity that you can be aggressive towards another person and hide under, you know, the name like, I'm going to get you 247 at Yahoo, you know, and I can't even imagine what young people and teenagers are dealing with. I mean, there's so many instances of, you know, teenagers killing themselves because of cyberbullying, which is something that we our generation, my specific generation, never had to deal with. If you were going to bully someone, you had to do it to their face.
This is a terrible problem. This is a serious problem because the phenomenon here is basically that the internet disinhibits. Once you're anonymous, people, it's the face-to-face encounter that civilizes us. And we're now face-to-face. And, you know, if you say something I don't like, you know, you're here with me. I'm going to politely say, I really didn't like that. I really didn't like that, and I'm not going to have any of that. And unless you're, you know, you want to be here talking to me, you're going to say, I'm sorry. And that's how it's going to work. And that's how it works in a kind of social contract. And that goes away. If you're anonymous, I'm anonymous, that goes away.
I do wonder a little bit about sort of as we're open and express ourselves online without boundaries, what is taken away when we lose those steps to get to know someone, those sort of formalities? You know, things are very open and informal online and people overshare, just like our show. What do we miss when we lose those steps of earning trust? We can just lay everything out. Is it received as aggression?
I think you miss the steps towards earning friendship, trust, and intimacy. You know, people don't. Reminds me of freshman week in college, where, boom, you're there. People share everything, and then by 2 weeks later, you know, at first, oh my God, you know, if that was your first experience with anything like that, you feel close to everybody. And then by 2 weeks later, most people realize, no, that wasn't it. That wasn't it. That was your first lesson. That wasn't it. That wasn't how it happens, really.
I think that's really important. Sort of, we can go through the facts of our intimate lives and sort of spew them out, but it doesn't necessarily replace the intimacy. That is something different.
Earned. Intimacy is earned. Friendship is earned. It doesn't happen in these bursts of sharing all and oversharing. And I mean, what is oversharing? Oversharing is saying things to people who haven't earned your trust. And any kind of confessional sites, any kind of, you know, secret share to groups, you know, to large groups. This is sharing for venting. This isn't sharing to people who've earned your trust. So it's a different kind of experience.
And I think, I mean, that really speaks to the title of your book, Alone Together, where, okay, you have people oversharing on Facebook. I mean, Facebook is such an interesting social phenomenon. I can go through my feed and there's always this one girl or one guy who just says something so personal and you don't even know what to do with the information. And yet it's like, maybe it's cathartic for them in some way, or maybe they're getting just a false sense of connection by exposing themselves and having people like their status or say, oh, it'll be okay, but no one's ever really getting into them about the real root problem of why they would be oversharing their personal lives on Facebook so intimately.
Well, I think people don't know what to say. I mean, I think that's the point. People don't know what to say. When somebody overshares you, it's first of all, you don't know them. If it was a close friend, you'd say, you know, where our friendship isn't up to this yet. You don't shut them down, but you say, hey, let's wait till we're closer to discuss this. Or let's discuss this next week after we've had next time we talk, let's talk about this. Or do we need to talk about this now? I don't feel quite ready to discuss this with you. I mean, there are nice ways of saying to somebody you care about, I'm not there yet.
Yeah, it's.
There's no nice way to say that to somebody you've never met. It's like without saying, you know, stop. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's interesting when I interview people who are on MOOCs and somebody shares something intimate or personal, or, you know, these are places that are designed for education that have bulletin boards and people share something painfully personal. People just say they kind of avert their eyes. They don't know what to do.
It's interesting. It's sort of opposite of watching a train wreck where some people are drawn to
the
disaster. This is like, you know, you want to avoid.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. One thing that I think we've all experienced as people being online and being a part of Facebook is Facebook stalking.
Yeah.
You know, so let's say, okay, I'll tell a personal story. So there was this boy I liked. And I Facebook friended him, and he didn't friend me back. And I was like, ugh, what's his problem? How could he not friend me back? And then I realized that it was because I was Facebook friends with his girlfriend. And then I was like, oh. And then for some reason, I started stalking his girlfriend. And so for months, I was looking at pictures of him through his girlfriend's eyes. For no reason I could consciously understand.
Because you were friends with a girlfriend.
On Facebook. I don't even remember. We must have met a couple times, had each other's emails addresses. Because, you know, Facebook just friends everyone that was in your email. So it was just interesting to me. I'm like, how come I'm doing this? I couldn't, I can intellectualize in the sense that you would look at, you know, what has she got that I don't have? Or looking at someone else's life in a sort of voyeurism curiosity. But it just was like a fascinating obsession of mine that I had to break after a couple months because I could recognize it was crazy, yet I couldn't stop myself from doing it. So, I mean, just the idea of Facebook stalking, I think we've all either Facebook stalked an ex-lover or somebody we like or someone we have a crush on. And what are we gaining by invading these persons, like this person's intimate life, especially when it's an ex who's moved on from you? I mean, what is that? What do you feel like that compulsion's about? And what are we gaining from doing that or losing from doing that?
Oh, this is so complicated. First of all, don't feel bad. The world is full. In other words, what you're doing is something that, you know, almost everybody says they do. It's not all. It's often with a romantic, you know, with somebody who there was a romantic connection to.
Right.
But sometimes it can be kind of a much more distant thing. It can be not always an erotically charged connection. It can be somebody you're curious about for other reasons. It can be a teacher. It can be just somebody whose life you always envied a little bit, or it's usually somebody who you admire or wanted to be in their life, but not always in a romantic way. I mean, a girl who you wished were you were like, or you wanted to have her life, or a celebrity whose life you wanted to have. I mean, it can be kind of, it usually is trying to figure out something about somebody else's life. And I think we've always wanted to know these things. I think people have always wanted to know, well, what happened to that guy? You know, what happened to that girl when they walked out of my life? And, you know, there were kind of limited ways of knowing. Every once in a while, you tried not to ask friends, but sometimes you could get a little information from a friend. But now, you can sort of find out, and it's painful, and sometimes it's painful, and then sometimes it's very painful. Usually, it's boring, but I think it's very human. But I think sometimes it gets out of control, particularly when people really don't move on with their lives and use this as a way to get stuck, use this as a support for getting stuck. And I think that's what people have to watch out for. I think the internet offers a lot of ways to get psychologically stuck. That doesn't mean there's anything wrong with the internet. It just means that it offers a lot of support for our human vulnerabilities. And I think that's what we have to watch out for, to use it in ways that move us forward and to be very respectful of how many ways it lets us get stuck.
I think that's one of the quotes I really liked in your book is you were interviewing someone who said, technology is bad because people are not as strong as its pull.
Yes.
How do we become stronger? How do we sort of...
Well, I think conversations like this, in other words, instead of saying, oh, technology is just a tool, it's always the same, we always just use it... We get used to it. We turn it to our own devices. I think it's better to have a little more healthy respect for this technology is particularly potent, and you know, I see that in our desire to say, well, there's nothing new under the sun, and we can just take the best of this, and we're awesome, and you know, we're just going to make this part of our lives like anything else, and. I think this technology is particularly potent in its psychological kick. And I think that a little more respect for it and respect for our vulnerability would really go a long way. And in this case, it offers so many things that kind of lock in to our vulnerability. And more respect for those, I think, would be very helpful.
I mean, one thing that I think about is that Grace and I are in the last generation to have had a childhood without phones and the internet.
Yes.
And just like I think about what to my daughter who's 3, or just the idea of, you know, we talk about, oh, go ask Google, go Google it, go, oh, you don't know the answer, go Google it. It's like Google must seem like a god to young people growing up because Google knows all the answers. And then, so there's this one element, which is this constant access to information, which has its positives, as we know, because of the global society. But at the same time, it has its negatives because, you know, there's less pontificating and wondering and researching in a more tangible way. You don't have to go to the library anymore. I never even really understood the Dewey Decimal System, but I at least had to try. Like, these are things that modern teenagers will never deal with. So, I mean, that's one question, is just like the influence of that. And then the other is just, you know, you talk a lot about teenagers and their relationships to their phones and the anxiety that it creates in them. So as a parent yourself, I mean, how have you been dealing with that with your own kids?
Well, I basically, my philosophy with Facebook was that this was for my daughter when she became a teenager. It was not for my daughter when she was a child. And when Mark Zuckerberg said he thought that Facebook was great for children, I've tweeted very little. I'm not a big tweeter, but I tweeted, nuh-uh, you know, this really was a tool. This was not a tool designed for play dates. This was, first it was college students, then it was high school students. It was really not for the 5 to 8 set. I mean, people need to play in the mud on the playground with other children, and they really don't need to be connecting and messaging each other. You know, I mean, everything that takes children away from face-to-face interaction when they're young is, in my opinion, not good. So this is when they learn to read each other's faces. It's when they learn to the subtle cues of body motion and negotiation, things they need to do face-to-face. So my position with my daughter was that was for when she was a teenager, and it was for her. So showed her how to use it, talked a lot about what the problems were, the ups and downs, and you know, the lay of the land and rules of the road. But then, and told her, you know, obviously to come to me if there were any problems. But then I told her that I'm not her Facebook friend, and this was really for her and her private social life, which I think is what Facebook should be. It should be for your teenager and his or her private social life. So I still felt that this was part of adolescence and their private social life. It's a kind of a rite of passage into adolescence and their private social life. Now, when there's a problem, you should be in close enough touch with your teenager that they come to you. But that was the way I handled Facebook. In other words, I insisted on seeing it as a grown-up thing, unlike the owners of Facebook. I held on to the dream that it was a grown-up thing, and you know, I'm not her Facebook friend. I'm still not her Facebook friend, and her Facebook account is something that I don't see. But when she was applying to college, I sat down with her and I said, "Here's what we're going to do. You have 2 weeks to clean up the pictures on your Facebook account. And all I want to do is look at the pictures on your site. Because colleges will look at them. I believe that colleges will look at the photographs on your..." So I did this when she was a sophomore, when the process kind of begins. "I believe that colleges are going to look at the pictures on your Facebook site." And or maybe when she was a beginning junior. "And, you know, you won't be in a good position to know what the photographs are that colleges won't want to see. Right. I have an adult eye. I'm an academic. I will know better than you." And sure enough, I have to laugh. There was a very funny picture, and I don't tell this. I tell this story with my daughter's permission. There was a very, very funny picture of my daughter with three of her lovely friends, girls. My daughter went to a girls' school in the Boston area, and there were three girls, lovely women, who were lying on a rug, wearing not particularly revealing, but you know, beautiful young women in tank tops, lying on a rug, drinking ginger ales. and it looked absolutely too luscious for, it just looked a very luscious photograph of 16-year-old girls lying on a rug drinking ginger ale. So I said to my daughter, this photograph has to go, shag rug, tip. And she says, Mommy, that photograph was during our summer in France. We're speaking French, so for my daughter, this was a photograph about, you know, French and intellectual exchange. I mean, this was a very high class photograph about speaking French, whereas, you know, to the unpracticed eye, this was close to soft porn. So, it's an example of, how I handle the parental responsibilities in the social media age. I left her alone. I hoped that the channels of communication were open, and I did a sweep with her permission. Without reading anything, I didn't read any messages. I left that to her, but I did look at the photographs, and in fact, we deleted the photographs. She let me have a say in deleting the photographs that I thought could be misunderstood, particularly the ones that were in French, but no one would know they were cultural exchange photographs. It was very funny.
That guidance is so important because
that's almost my favorite story. Her reaction was so innocent. Mommy, that's all happening in French.
Right. And as a young person, you shouldn't, it's nice that you don't necessarily see the world as the adults that see it. So that's great. Right. So it's so important to have that kind of
guidance. I love that story for some reason.
It's great. And it also, the idea that our Facebook page is our avatar a little bit, and the other people look at it and see, you know, like, what is this person really like, or what, right. You know, when Tony was talking about someone not friending them on Facebook, and just going back to that idea of, you know, this people wanting things from you and needing to be accountable to other people, and that it comes from all directions and can almost feel oppressive in some ways. And so we're creating this sort of on-call status always. And when we do that, we do take away from that leisure time. And, you know, Tony was talking about, you know, my daughter won't necessarily need to ever go to the library. And it made me think about, you know, what other societies don't have those kinds of things. And, you know, when you look at other kinds of governments, a totalitarian government or something, they take away those public spaces. They take away, you know, libraries. They don't want people to have that time for leisure talk, that space and time. And, in having respect for it is so important. And do you think, you know, we're creating this restrictive environment for ourselves, that we're always accountable? Like, is there some...
Well, I worry that we've taken away public space and we've put it online instead of having public space. I don't think this is necessarily a positive development. I love public libraries. I think that we need more places where people go in real time and do things together. So I think that the loss of public space is a very important.
Where
are the places for conversation today?
Exactly, and that leisure time where your mind wanders. I feel like that
in the town in which you live, are there places for conversation?
I mean, absolutely. There are definitely, you know, the beach or yoga communities or classes that you can go to, or you can meet at the organic grocery store. But there isn't a forum specifically for that. I mean, we definitely don't have that. And there also, I mean...
Is there a town hall where people go to talk?
They go to use the computers. They go to, you know, people go to the library now to get on the computer. They go to the community center to get online and check their email. I feel like, you know, that happens a lot.
Not to talk to each other.
No, definitely not. And then this idea of oppression and how no matter where you are, you can get a text asking something of you. Or no matter where you are, if someone doesn't get a hold of you by calling you, they can email you, or they can Facebook you, or they can tweet you. I mean, we have this constant accountability to our personal network to always be answering people. like, it's really hard to just not be on your phone for 8 hours and not have a bunch of people demanding your time and attention.
It is very difficult. And I think people are responding to that in different ways. I mean, some people, I think people feel that their lives are very pressured and frenetic and don't necessarily have the space for, you know, there's work in your job. And a lot of people say, I'm doing my job, but I don't have time for my work. Or I certainly don't have time for my family or for my creative life, or I'm wasting this time on the net. I mean, I think there's a lot of sense of a kind of buildup of pressure, unless people learn to make, you know, kind of draw the lines.
It seems like there's this undervalue of not doing anything. And so you're not busy, why don't you answer me, kind of thing. And
yes, you're not busy, why don't you answer me?
Right. Where that time of doing nothing is not really doing nothing. It's really important. And the sort of being busy is has so much prestige to it. And so I think, you know, there's something about that overworking, having so much status, you know, being important. And so when you're doing nothing, it's equated with laziness. Just like instead of solitude, we say loneliness. It's like having downtime is being lazy or not being mm-hmm. efficient somehow.
Absolutely. And I think that's a big problem, because downtime is not laziness. Downtime is creative time. And the question is, how can you revalue downtime so it's not equated with laziness? That's a very good way to put it. In the same way that being alone is not equated with loneliness, but can be equated with solitude.
Yeah, and one thing that, you know, having heard you speak for this past 45 minutes, all I can think about is, wow, she's really balanced, and she has a lot of personal boundaries and understanding of it. And it's like you just seem like a personality type that knows yourself and is able to, you know, have a responsible relationship with your technology and your children. I mean, I was really delighted to hear about how you respect your daughter's privacy. And I think you're actually of the few. That's a rare respect that you're demonstrating.
Well, I was very lucky in that my daughter also gave me no reason to. I mean, I just want to speak to all those parents who are tearing out their hair because their children are being cyberbullied and getting into terrible trouble. And, you know, that wasn't my case. In other words, my daughter made it easy for me to respect her privacy. In other words, we never had terrible incidents. But I think that once you find out that your child is the object of bullying, aggressive threats, is bullying other children. I mean, I think that, you know, it's all well and good for me to take this position because I didn't have
anything drastic to interfere
terrible,
with.
Anything terrible happened. In other words, what I'm describing is what I think is the, what do they call it in ballet? Basic first position.
You know, right.
Sort of like, you know, feet turned out. You know, this is starting position. You start from a position that this is, that your child. But I think key to this is you don't put your child online when they're five.
Right.
I mean, you know, I think that if you put your child online when they're babies, you're going to get into trouble. Because there's no way that a very young person is going to be able to know the rules of the road. And I think that the encouragement to put children online earlier and earlier is going to get you into trouble. Smartphones in the hands of eight-year-olds, I don't see it. So what? They don't Google something.
Right.
Do they need to know this stuff? I mean, what do they need to know so much? I mean, I really don't think... That a 5-year-old, 6-year-old, 7-year-olds need to Google is as great as some members of the education community seem to think. So
yeah, maybe it's just a way for parents to avoid the question, why? Why, mommy?
Well, <I'll look> it up. Yeah, but you know, when children are asking why, they're trying to put the world together.
Right.
They're trying to figure out who they are and what's the world, and they want to feel that their parents kind of have a sense of it.
And sometimes they're just trying to engage.
And like sometimes they're trying to engage their parents.
They didn't need to know exact answers.
Yeah. You know, why is the sky blue is a chance to talk about a lot of stuff. And to just interpret that as as it's a moment to learn about light diffusion, I think is a very, very bad call.
Right, like you can really over-intellectualize and over-explain something and take the magic out of the world by just being like, oh, well, there's an answer for that, and I can find it on Google, and it's perfectly scientific. It's almost existing too much in the rational mind.
Yeah.
By having an exact explanation.
I think that it's a chance to talk to your child and or discover it together or, you know, I think that children also often ask, I think, to engage and also to watch a parent learn. And I'm not sure that one of my favorite, as I say, I'm writing a book about conversation now, and one of my favorite quotes, you always have a favorite quote, favorite thing that somebody says to you. And one of my favorite things that I think she was 14, she said to me, she was talking about having dinner with her dad, and something came up at a movie they'd seen and who had done the photography. And he starts to look it up on his phone, and she says, "Daddy, stop Googling. I want to talk to you." And it just stuck with me because I think it so captures this iconic moment when a kid is just saying, no, don't.
That's not what I'm looking
for. That's not what I'm looking for here. I just want to have a conversation with you. I really didn't mean to trigger this. You know, I really didn't mean to trigger this.
Yeah, and I think as parents, we just want to provide everything we can for our children. And there's this richness out there of information. And so, yeah, it makes us feel, completely wise beyond, imagination. And but saying, "I don't know," is so powerful.
Think you have to keep your eye on what your children really are asking for and keep open the possibility that your children really are not asking for information. They really are not asking for information. I think that's very important.
So, one thing that I can admit as a parent to a young child is the relationship I've had to my phone while my kid is growing up. So I actually wrote an article that was called "Mommy, Can You Put Your iPhone Down?"
Uh-huh.
Because I realized that, being with a young kid, I was with her a lot. There was a certain, I'm going to use the word boredom because I know that intellectually I know boredom is a sign of a weak mind. And was I really bored? Or was I really just hiding from, the recesses of my own psyche? But it's like I would play outside with her, but I would often be listening to a podcast, especially before she talked. So in a way it really helped me as a young parent just like be there for my child and play outside and do things that otherwise I would have been more antsy. But then I have to admit the complexity of like, well, was I really present if I'm listening to something while we're outside doing stuff? So, there is this conundrum about how the phones and the internet and the connectivity does on some level, bring us to a place where life is almost more pleasant to deal with, but at what cost? And I mean, that's obviously the thesis of your book, but I would just love for you to just like speak on that and distill what we could take away, because I do think a lot of us are struggling with these
well, I think it's
relationships.
I think it's a balance. What I think is that my suggestion, I live across the street from a playground, and I do a lot of my work sitting in this playground observing parents with their kids. And what I observe is that parents, both young mothers and young fathers, obviously feel a pressure to spend many more hours with their children than previous generations of parents felt. My mother did not go to the playground with me. I went to the playground alone. now all the studies are showing that children don't go to the playground unaccompanied. They're
considered neglectful.
So the parents are with their children, and but they're texting. They're on their phones. And the children, I think, are in more danger because they've made the playground so safe that they're so boring. But nevertheless, they're on whatever little boring, safe but boring little not really a swing or not really a jungle gym, right, or whatever.
A foam-covered slide.
Right, a foam-covered slide that's 2 inches from the ground or whatever it is. But they're on whatever it is that they have, or they're doing whatever it is that they're doing without holding on or whatever, they're because they're trying to get, desperately trying to get their parents' attention on whatever over-safe, you know, piece of equipment they're on. And they cannot get their parents' attention because the parent is on their phone. So, and it's just the saddest thing to watch. And I, you know, I'm there to observe, not to do family intervention. So I don't really rip the phones out of parents' hands or do anything too major. But, you know, I would say that to all the mothers who are listening to podcasts as they watch their children or texting in the playground or really, you know, bringing their laptops, you know, to games, you know, to school, sports games, is if you have an hour a day to spend with your child, you know, really full attention, tell the child, you know, I have an hour, I'm working, I have other things, mommy has other things to do, but I have an hour in which I'm all yours, and here's our hour. And give him the hour and put away your stuff and give them the hour and make that your time. And then I think children, in the age-old tradition of children since forever, will tolerate their mothers. You know, it used to be that the mothers were doing the laundry and the, you know, and cleaning the house, and now the mothers are doing, you know, working with their audio equipment and, you know, whatever. You know, then the mothers are doing the other things they're doing. I think that's much better than what children have now, which is this continuous partial attention, have part attention, be there. They're not there. They are there. They never know. They're trying to get their mother's attention. They're getting into crazy accidents because they're, even on the safest equipment, they're, you know, they're their real energy is going into trying to scream and get their parents' attention. They're angry because when they finally make a play in the game at school, they're, you know, they're, nobody's watching the game. I mean, it's sad. And of course, I hear it from the children's point of view because I interview the children, and they're mad as hell.
Right. It feels like the love is conditional. It feels like this other thing is taking away their attention. It's like more important than they are.
Yeah, but it's funny. It's not conditional in the old way. It's such an interesting way to put it, because it's not that it's conditional in the old way, like if they succeed, they'll get the love.
Right.
Because they're succeeding. They're making the touchdown or the score in hockey, I mean, whatever that is they're doing. They're succeeding, but the father still didn't look up to watch the scoring. So it's not even, the love is the love is shared. The attention is shared no matter what they do. So it's not clear what they have to do to get the mother to put the phone down. So they're clueless. They are succeeding. They are scoring the points. But when a dad brings his email to the game, it's not clear what the son, who's supposed to be just busy playing the game, is supposed to do to get the father to look up at the right time. It's sort of not a... You know, if the father isn't watching the game, these games move quickly. You know, God. So it's a very curious anger that builds up, sort of like, I never have your full attention. So I think that that's what I'm seeing more from children, the sense that they don't know how to navigate this. And they get quite angry. This new work is filled with angry children who feel that they don't know how to get their parents' attention. So my suggestion, my strong suggestion, is if you don't have, it's totally reasonable if you don't have 5 hours to spend with your child, if you don't have 3 hours, if you don't have 2 hours, if you have an hour, if you have 20 minutes when you can just completely focus in, if that's the reality, just give them that hour, give them that 20 minutes. There's no shame in that.
I mean, I think that's also advice we need to take with each other too. You know, when you're around friends, when you're around loved ones, even when you're around yourself, we owe it to ourselves, we owe it to the people that we care about, to definitely give them undivided attention.
For at least some of the time.
At least some of the time.
Right.
And have that be, you know, when you kept mentioning this word respect, we have to respect that new technology. And part of respecting the technology is truly respecting the need for genuine human interaction.
Yes.
And genuine solitude, time to yourself, to just think, contemplate, reflect, and just be by yourself. Give yourself the respect.
Yes, to give be yourself alone. Give yourself the time to be alone.
Well, I really appreciate this conversation.
It's been a pleasure.
I definitely want to come back and talk to you about transhumanism at some point, because I do think our future could be a transhumanist nightmare. But that's just such another...
Well, it's nice to end on a more positive note yeah. about what we can do to be more respectful of each other.
I feel like you had some great advice.
Before we get on to the transhumanist nightmare.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you.